President George H.W. Bush, known for a lot of things, but I think this might be one of the most quotable quotes back in 1990. I do not like broccoli. I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it. And I'm president of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli. I can appreciate that. For me, when I was a little kid, it was spinach. Now, I like a nice spinach salad, but when I was a kid, the only spinach we ever got, it seemed like, was out of the can. That stuff was terrible. All the adults liked it, but I couldn't handle it. So I can identify with this. We all have this or that that we just don't like. We could all make a list. I don't like this. I don't like that. And our list would be different. But here's something I think that if we thought about it deeply enough would be on every person's list. Conflict. We don't like conflict. I mean, how many people do you know that just wake up in the morning and say, oh man, great, another day, I can't wait to get in another argument with somebody? I don't think so. There might be a few people like that. I don't think we would be in that category. We don't relish those times when things go wrong and people get upset, arguments take place, all the rest. But conflict is here to stay. It's a part of life. It's existed almost as long as the created world. Actually, it begins way before that. And it will exist until this world is said and done and the Lord's judgment comes. For example, Lucifer rebelled against God back in eternity past. Conflict. Read about it in Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. Later on, after God created man, Adam disobeys God. Partakes of the hidden fruit, forbidden fruit, Genesis 3. And then promptly blames his wife. More conflict. Not only between God and Adam, but now between Adam and Eve, certainly, to some extent. In the next chapter of Genesis, chapter 4, one of their sons, Cain, murders another, Abel. Joseph's brothers later on, Genesis chapter 37, his brothers sell him into slavery out of jealousy. Satan tempted Jesus on the Mount of Temptation. That conflict between God and Satan endures. And he will devour us if he has half a chance. 1 Peter 5:8 says that he walks around looking for an opportunity to devour us, just like a roaring lion seeks to devour his prey. He'll destroy our life if we yield to his temptation and let him have the sway in our life. But in the end, and only when this world is over, the final judgment comes, will Satan be judged and cast into the lake of fire. And conflict will end. You might say, well, why does God allow all this conflict? Why has He allowed it? Why does He allow it? Well, obviously, we can point back to choices. Satan's choice in the beginning to rebel against God. Adam's choice in the beginning to disobey God. The choices you and I have made in life. We could come up with some answers, I suppose, as to why God allowed it. But that's not really my concern this morning. There's some things we don't know completely, and maybe this is one that would fall into that category. But I do know this. I know that God is bigger than any of our problems, and I know that God can take the conflict that exists in this world, the spiritual conflict, the personal, the interpersonal conflicts we have, the struggle we have as Christians with this world we live in, He can take it all and He can produce good things in our life in spite of it and actually through it. So we shouldn't fear conflict. It's an opportunity. You say, wait a minute. I was with you to this point, Pastor, but I don't know about this opportunity thing. How could something that can go so wrong between two people, or a conflict that can be so intense in a family, such as it was with Jacob's family, as we're going to see here in a few moments, how can that be an opportunity? Well, I'm not going to answer that question right now. I'm going to put you off on that for just a little bit. We will come back to it. All I want you to do is just trust me right now, because as we get through this, the message and the story in Genesis 31, we'll have the answer. But it is an opportunity. However, it will only be an opportunity to the extent that we handle the conflict correctly. If we mishandle it, the opportunity for anything good might be lost. Not necessarily, but it certainly might be. We certainly remove the blessing out of anything good that comes from it, that's for sure, if we mishandle it. So every conflict is an opportunity if we handle it correctly. Now go with me to the book of Genesis, chapter 31. Jacob had spent 7 years working for Laban, his kinsman, because he did not have a dowry, as the custom was in those days, for Rachel. He worked 7 years, gave his labor instead. Now the dowry in those days and in that culture was basically to prove that he had the wherewithal to support the wife. Well, everything's fine and dandy until Laban tricks Jacob. And on the wedding night substitutes the older daughter, Leah, for the one that Jacob had bargained for, Rachel. Jacob was a little bit upset about that. Just a little bit. And when he went to Laban about it, Laban agreed to go ahead and give him Rachel too, and made some flimsy excuse by, well, you know, we always marry, always give the older daughter first, and so on. But he went ahead and gives him Rachel as a second wife. Now that in itself was aside from and apart from and in opposition to and disobedience to the scriptures. Scriptures such as Genesis 2:24, where it says one man should marry one woman, the two shall become one flesh. But this is what happened. Then he had to work for Rachel another 7 years. That's 14 years. And then when he mentioned leaving at that point, Laban said, you know, you've been such a blessing to me, and I've benefited, and God's blessed you, and I've benefited. Well, stay a while longer. He ends up staying another period of time, and he spends 20 years in Mesopotamia working for Laban. Only the last portion, the last 6 years, he's accumulating his own flock. And we went through that story, and we will not revisit it. But now in chapter 31, we come to a real crisis in the family. Conflict between Jacob and Laban has come to a head. Jacob knows it's time to depart. You see, Laban was the con man of con men. And Jacob was known as the trickster. He tricks his brother out of the birthright and all of that. But he met his match and more in Laban. And yet, God stepped in at every juncture, at every turn, and blessed Jacob to the expense of Laban. And that's just creating more conflict and more animosity in Laban. So this is where we're at now in chapter 31, verse 1, where we read now, Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and he said to them, I see your father's countenance that is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my fathers has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father. I'll drop down, if you will, to verse 14. And Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. The first thing we want to notice here in regard to how Jacob handled this conflict is a negative. He made a mistake. He didn't handle things as he should. And that leads us to the first admonition as far as we are concerned. If we are going to handle conflict correctly, we must not run away from it. Don't avoid dealing with it. Avoidance is not the proper response. The avoidance of conflict does not solve the problem. You see, sometimes we kind of deny conflict exists, but there comes a point when, like in this case, in verse 1, Jacob heard the remarks of Laban's sons. He saw in verse 2 the countenance of Laban, his disposition. He mentions that again in verse 5. Even his wives, Rachel and Laban, said, you know, our father doesn't care about us as far as we're concerned. He's strangers. He's consumed with, he's focused on, he's only thinking about himself. I remember Jacob had bargained for the speckled and spotted animals that were produced by the flock, and that was to be his pay. And Laban was to have the best of the flock, the white lambs and the black and so forth. And every time that they made a bargain like this, God would just bless Jacob. And all of a sudden, there were more speckled, more spotted. Jacob had more. Well, Laban would come along, as we're going to find out here in a minute, and he'd switch the thing. And God would just bless in the appropriate way that it would come to Jacob. And this is what was taking place because Laban was far from God and Jacob was trying to serve God. So it was becoming obvious to Jacob they had a problem. And he says, well, you know, we've got to get out of here. We've got to move. We've got to leave this place. Verse 17. Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels. And he carried away all of his livestock and all of his possessions which he had gained. His acquired livestock which he had gained in Padan Aram to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. So he says, I'm out of here. But he doesn't tell Laban. They go unannounced. I mean, they leave without telling them what they're doing. They just move quickly. Now, remember, Laban's share of the flock was 3 days' journey away. So it's going to take a little while for Laban to hear of the thing. And when he finally does, he's not happy. Why was it that Jacob decided to run? He didn't want to deal with the conflict. I mean, every time he had tried to deal with Laban, it was never really resolved. So you can't blame him to some extent, but this was not the proper way to settle things. This was not solving the problem. It was running away from the problem, as much like we still do today. Sometimes we change jobs because of conflict. Sometimes we end relationships because of conflict. Sometimes we switch churches because of some conflict. It doesn't solve the conflict. It only puts distance between us and the conflict. Now, I want you to look at verse 14 again. Rachel says, "Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money." In other words, all the labor Jacob put into it, all the benefit that came to Laban, Laban hadn't been wise with it. There wasn't going to be anything come to them. Laban consumed it all in his own lusts. But this is a statement of a daughter here who was somewhat bitter at her father. And sometimes we allow our bitterness to become an excuse for not dealing with a conflict. I think that's what happened here. I want you to drop down to verse 17 for just a moment. This is where we were before. "And Jacob rose and set his sons and wives on camels and carried them all away," verse 18. Look at verse 19. "Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's." Now we'll come back to this in a moment, so just hold that thought you have there. "And Jacob stole away unknown to Laban the Syrian, that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead." That's back in the Promised Land. "And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled." Eventually now, I want you to go down to verse 31. When Laban finally catches up to Jacob, they're clear back over in the land of Israel, what would become the land of Israel, Mount Gilead. And Laban in verse 30 says, "Why did you steal my gods?" Now we'll come back to that again in a moment. Hold that thought. But look at verse 31. "Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force.'" Fear is the biggest motivation for fleeing from conflict. We fear the loss of esteem in someone else's eyes. We fear their wrath. We have had issues and problems with people growing up or at home or whatever. And we kind of transfer that to every conflict we have in life. And then we just develop a phobia, if you will, a fear of the thing. Now, in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 25, Jesus said, "Agree with your adversary quickly." Don't hesitate. Don't put it off. If there's an issue between you and someone, handle it promptly. "Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge and the judge hand you over to the officer." Now, that, of course, is Roman law there, as was the case many years later when Jesus said that, the way that lawsuits were handled that he's talking about. But he's saying, basically, settle the thing. Deal with the issues. Don't let it come to a court problem or a legal problem for you. And that's good advice for all of us. Don't be afraid to deal with conflict. Now, there's a second admonition here that we can discern in the Scriptures. First of all, we said don't avoid dealing with conflict. Number two is don't retaliate against an adversary. That's very important because that's a temptation. And that's where I want to take you back to verse 19, where it says, "Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's." Why did she do that? She didn't need them. Are we to believe that Rachel was an idol worshiper? I don't think so. She stole them to get back at her father. This is the thing that really irritates Laban, as we see later on, down in verse 30, when that's the first thing he says to Jacob when he catches up to him. Basically, you know, not only did you leave and didn't tell me, but you took my household gods, my household idols. That's what really was on his mind. It seems that Laban being the con man that he was, the gambler that he was, so to speak, I think kind of hedged his bets religiously. Now, his father, as we trace it down through Abraham, was a worshiper of the only God, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Laban, maybe so, but I think he was probably one of these guys that was just kind of eclectic, and he kind of also, maybe perhaps, got into some idol worship. But that aside, we know culturally in that land where Laban lived, there was some sort of connection between who possessed the household idols and who received the inheritance. And what was it that Rachel complained about earlier on, we read, when she said, he's taken everything that was ours and spent it. I think, to one degree or another, Rachel was trying to hit Laban where it hurt the most. Even if he didn't have much, she wanted to have control of it when he died. Retaliation. Now, going back to Laban's response to this whole thing. Verse 22, and Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled, that he took his brethren with him and pursued for 7 days' journey. He got his men together, and they got their animals they were riding on, they got their weapons, and they took off. He chased them down. He was upset. Rachel retaliates, and what's that do? It just adds fuel to the fire. It just adds fuel to the conflict. It just makes the problem bigger. It never solves anything to retaliate. It only makes things worse. He eventually arrives and he searches the place. Let's look at verse 31. After Jacob's accused of stealing the gods, Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, he said, perhaps that you would take your daughters from me by force. Then he says this in verse 32, with whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. Now, Jacob has no idea that Rachel, his beloved Rachel, is the one who did it. I don't know if he made that statement. But he is so sure that nobody in his group has done this that he makes that statement. Now, the verses that follow tell about Jacob giving Laban permission to search through all their tents, which he did, and he never found them. And of course, Rachel lying on the basically the saddle of a camel, which was used as a bed at times, saying that she could not come up or get up because it was her time of the month and so on, and she had hid the idols underneath that saddle. So Laban does not find them. But the damage has been done. Romans 12, verse 17 says, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If you go on and you read verses 18, 19, and 20 there in Romans, it talks about the fact that we have an obligation to do good to those who are evil, and to do good to those who mistreat us. And by doing so, Paul says you'll keep coals of fire on their head. Now, that's not retaliation. That was an ancient gesture of putting a pot of coals on your head, an ancient gesture that you were repentant. So he's saying the better we are, the better we treat people that are mean to us, the more good we do to those who would hurt us, the more likely we're to see them acknowledge their wrong and seek our forgiveness. So we've noticed so far, don't avoid and don't retaliate. Now there's a third way to handle conflict here that we see in this chapter. And this is what we need to learn to do. This is what Jacob eventually does, but not at first. And here it is. Promptly confront offenders. Promptly confront offenders. When I say confront, I mean you go to them and you You deal with it. You speak to them. You tell them what they've done wrong. You tell them what how they've hurt you, whatever. You seek to resolve the problem and bring about peace. The problem that a lot of Christians have with this is that down deep inside they think, well, you know, isn't that being kind of judgmental? Well, think about this from Jacob's perspective here. And I want you to look at verse 35. Verse 36, actually. After Laban fails to find the household idols, verse 36, then Jacob was angry. You know, see, that's where you end up if you avoid conflict for a period of time. It doesn't resolve anything. Things get worse, and eventually you get so angry, then you deal with it. At least Jacob finally deals with it. At least he confronts Laban here. And he was justifiably angry. I'm not saying he was sinfully angry. I'm just saying he could have avoided the snowballing of his anger if he would have dealt with it when he should have. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. There's the confrontation. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between us both. These 20 years, says Jacob, I have been with you. Your ewes and female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand. Whatever, whether it was stolen that day or stolen in the night, there I was in the day of the drought, in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost at night, and my sleep departed from me. Thus have I been in your house 20 years. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. In other words, every time Laban saw God blessing Jacob over here, he changed the terms of the deal. Jacob said, I'll take the spotted and the speckled ones, the ones that nobody wants, the lesser ones, the ones that were much fewer normally, that were born into the flock. And what does God do? God just blesses the flock with speckled and spotted ones. Jacob benefits. And no doubt Laban comes along and switches it. So, okay, let me have the speckled and the spotted. And as sure as he does, what happens? The black and the white proliferate. And I don't know if that's exactly how it happened, but 10 times Jacob tried to redo things, rechange things, go back on his word, rewrite the contract for his own benefit, and every time, it blew up in his face. Jacob benefited. That's true. But there was conflict all along, every day, every week, every month, every year for 20 years. And he finally gets right in Laban's face and says, this is what you've done. Now, why do we struggle with that? Well, so often, again, I believe we as Christians mistakenly believe that confrontation is judgment. And we all know the Scripture says, judge not that you be not judged. Matthew 7:1. But if you read the verses that follow Matthew 7:1, what does he say? He says, first take the beam out of your own eye, the log out of your own eye, before you try to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. And after you've taken the beam out of your own eye, after you've got that log, that big chunk of wood out of your own eye, then you can see clearly to help remove the spot out of your brother's eye. He's not saying we shouldn't confront, or he wouldn't have given that whole scenario of the log and the speck. When he says judge not, he uses the Greek terminology here, the Greek word translated judge, which means to render a verdict on someone's life. We are never to stand in judgment of a person. We never have the right to say, oh, so-and-so is just not a Christian. Or, oh, so-and-so, you know, they're just lost and sinners. And you know, we don't have the right to render those judgments. On the other hand, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 15, the Bible says, but he who is spiritual judges all things. We don't judge people, but we judge things. We don't judge people, but we judge what people do. And if people do what they should not do and it offends us, it hurts us, we are to confront them about that. We're not saying anything about their eternal destiny. We're not casting any judgment on the person as far as their eternal life is concerned or their spiritual life or their place in the body of Christ. We're just simply saying what you did needs to be dealt with. So confronting people is not a violation of the command to judge not. Now, why is it that we need to confront? We need to confront in order to achieve reconciliation or peace. Jesus said if you bring your gift to the altar, that was in the day of the sacrificial system, so it's a little different, but the application is this. If you come to church to worship God, and you remember your brother has an issue with you that you've been unwilling to resolve, you should cease to worship, go to your brother, make amends, settle that thing, and then go back to your worship. Matthew 5, verses 23 and 24. In Matthew 18, just the opposite. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. No matter which side of the equation you're on, whether you've been offended or you've done the offending, in both cases, you compare Matthew 5, 23 and 24 and Matthew 18, 15, in both cases, both parties are obligated to confront in order to be reconciled and bring about peace. Now, here's an example in Scripture, Galatians chapter 2, verse 11. Paul is in Antioch, along with Barnabas. Having been sent there from the church in Jerusalem, they stay. This is the second Baptist church in the Middle East, I guess you'd say. And Peter, who is a part of the church in Jerusalem, comes to visit. And there was a group of people in the church in Antioch that was causing problems. They were trying to live the Old Testament law, not realizing that it had all passed away at the cross of Christ. Didn't realize they were to live in freedom and grace. And so they refused to eat any of the meats that was forbidden under the law. And they separated themselves from the other Christians in the church. And when Peter came, they kind of put their arms around old Peter and said, you know, you need to come over here and do what we're doing. We're the really kosher group. You know, we're the really Jewish group here, the way things should be. You know, we haven't given up the old ways and the old traditions. And Peter knew better, but Peter did that. And Paul confronts him, according to Galatians 2:11. And he tells us this in that verse. Now, when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. Now, we know of no rift between Paul and Peter after that. So I believe this was a successful confrontation. Peter was in the wrong and realized it. But I like the way it's phrased here. He says, I withstood him to his face. Now, we're good at withstanding people behind their backs. But we're not very good at withstanding people to their face. Also like what we find in the book of Proverbs chapter 15, verse 23, where it says, a man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. When we deal with things up front, promptly, when we should, how we should, it's a good thing. Now, we fear that the confrontation will just make it worse. If it does, it's not our fault. But if we don't confront, we give up any opportunity to make it better. Look what the Scripture says. Do not correct a scoffer. The word scoffer in the Hebrew means mouth. That means if somebody is continually a person who won't listen to you and won't listen to anybody, but instead is always telling everybody else what's wrong and how to live and why they're always right, don't waste your time. Because if you try to correct that person, they'll hate you. But a wise man's different. He says, rebuke a wise man and he will love you. You know, I don't like to be rebuked. I'll just tell you that up front. It'll make me instantly mad. Excuse me, that's the wrong term. It'll make me instantly angry. Might make me mad too for a few moments. Where I get most of my rebuke is right at home. And my wife could tell you flat out, I don't like to be rebuked and I will react. And then, you know, a few hours later, I got to come back and admit she's right, like she always is. It might not be instantaneous, but hopefully it doesn't mean instantaneous here. But a wise man, a wise man will appreciate. A wise person will love you if you help them see the problem. Proverbs 28, verse 23 says, he who rebukes a man will find more favor afterward that he who flatters with his tongue. Boy, think that one through. You try to manipulate people, flatter people, not really call them where they're wrong, not really confront them with the issues you need to confront them with, you're not going to get near the results. You're not going to have their favor, their love, to the extent you would if you just spoke the truth in love. Now, having said all of that, I began by saying that confrontation was an opportunity. I wouldn't want to take a vote on this here today. I'm afraid we wouldn't get 100% to agree with that statement. But let's just fast forward a little bit in the story of Jacob. To Jacob's 10th son, Joseph. What happened to Joseph? Now, it wasn't all Joseph's fault. He was young and naive, and his talking about things and bragging, maybe to some degree, led his brothers to dislike him. And it was more Jacob's fault for favoring him, the first son born to Rachel. But because of his status in the family, in the eyes of Jacob, and the special coat that Jacob had made for him, the other 9 brothers hated Joseph. And they would have killed him if it wasn't for a couple of the brothers interceding. Says, no, let's not kill him. They just put him in a pit, and they waited until a caravan headed to Egypt came by, and they sold him into slavery, and then they put the lamb's blood on his garments and convinced his daddy had been killed by an animal. And off went Joseph, never to be seen again as far as they were concerned. Talk about family conflict. That's pretty extreme. Well, we know the story. Joseph is purchased by a man by the name of Potiphar. And Joseph is of such a character. And God's blessing was on him to such a degree that the first thing you know, Potiphar just puts Joseph in charge of his whole household and all of his property. And then what happens? Potiphar's wife has designs on Joseph. Joseph won't cooperate because he's a righteous man. And there's conflict between Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and she tells the lie, and Potiphar sends Joseph to prison. Twice Joseph has been kicked in the teeth. Joseph goes to prison. He is a person of such character, and he's a person that God blesses to such a degree that the head of the prison before long puts Joseph in charge of the whole prison, even though he's a prisoner. And then the Pharaoh, the head man in Egypt, sends the butler and the baker to prison, and he interprets their dreams. And we remember that whole story. And when the one who survives has the opportunity to go before Pharaoh for Joseph because of what he said, he doesn't do it. 3 times Joseph kicked in the teeth. But eventually, God afflicts Pharaoh with a dream, and the whole story leads back to Joseph because of what he had done in prison. Joseph interprets a dream. Joseph gets out of prison. He is a man of such character, and God blesses him to such a degree that the first thing you know, he's running the entire country of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And we know that when the famine came, it was predicted by the dream that God sent to Pharaoh. The only way that Jacob and those nine brothers, well, more brothers than that by this time, but the only way they survive is by coming to Egypt for grain. And guess who's running Egypt? Well, Joseph, he takes care of them in spite of all they've done to him. He forgives them. He gives them grain. He moves them to Egypt. And then eventually, Jacob dies. Then the brothers are really concerned. No, he's not going to treat us so well now that Jacob's gone. So they come to him in Genesis chapter 50, apologizing and asking forgiveness all over again. And here's what Joseph said in verse 20. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now, how do you understand that? How do you fathom that those brothers hated him so much they did what he did, but yet God used it to save those very brothers and the household of Jacob those many years later? In conflict, there is opportunity. Jacob never held a grudge. He never retaliated. He forgave his brothers in spite of it all because he knew God was bigger than that. Bigger than all that had happened to him. And listen, think about it this way. If there had been no conflict between Jacob and Laban those 20 years, do you think Jacob would have been headed back to the promised land to confront his angry brother Esau? I think not. At least there would have been the temptation that Jacob would have said, hey, I got it so good over here. Why would I want to go? Lord, why would you want to send me back there? That's where Esau's at. And I took the birthright and all from him, and he'll probably kill me. If it wasn't for all the conflict he had with Laban, I don't know what he would have, what choice he would have made. God gives us opportunity when we handle conflict correctly.